This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
After lunch, they're back in the courtroom, and we're going to take you right there, right now, with continuing coverage.
You may now be seated.
Yes, sir.
Please, Court, Your Honor, before the jury brought in, I have a matter of law I'd like to deal with.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, we've been informed by the Attorney General, who's been very accommodating. We've told him who he's going to call this afternoon or this morning. One of the witnesses would be Brett Dove. And Brett Dove, I think they'll agree, is the person that did retrieve the extract from, you heard, the Secret Service agent this morning, and did some analysis on it. I'd like to show the court. Is this working? Can I have the Omar? State's Exhibit Number 299. Where can I see that? Let me see it online. Okay, and this is. Wait, just let me have you push it up in just a minute. You don't need to. That's a receipt of property for Paul Murdaugh's phone. And if you'll slide the thing down a little bit, no, the other way, you'll see that Bobby, what's his last name, Bancroft?
Right.
Received it from David Owens, who gave it to Bobby Bancroft, who then gave it to...
Kelly.
Gave it to who?
R. Kelly?
Yeah. Right. And then Paul McGonigal, we heard from this morning, gave it to, he was at the Charleston Sheriff's Office, gave it to, whose name is that?
Is it signature?
Looks like Brian Hedick, who gave it to, well, it got to Brian Hedick at Computer Crimes, I guess by Ryan Kelly. The point I'm trying to make, Judge, let me show you the second page, is there are a number of people in the chain of custody on this phone who haven't testified yet. As a result, if Mr. Dove is allowed to testify about the contents of the phone, which he received from Secret Service, we believe that breaks, that would not complete the chain of custody. All we're saying is call these other people, and I mean, they're not going to be long witnesses, to complete the chain, to authenticate that what exactly came out of that phone was the phone that was found at the scene on Paul Murdaugh's body. I don't know if this is complicated or not, but it seems to me that they ought to have to do that.
Mr. Waters?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very quickly, as we look at the chain and I'll take those, thank you. On Paul's phone, again, Mr. Conrad is going to call Brett, Lieutenant Dove here in a bit. We've had testimony from Jason Chapman about David Owen securing that phone. We've had introduction into evidence, Your Honor, without objection, of both of these chain sheets. There was no qualification or objection to the information on these chain sheets, no hearsay objection or anything like that on both of these, which carried the chain all the way through. And then, of course, but we have testimony about the collection of that phone. We have testimony from multiple witnesses about the manner in which agents secure phones and the rest of that. And then we have testimony about that phone going essentially through a couple of couriers to Paul McGonigal, who just testified as to his involvement with that phone, as well as to his delivery of that back to Lieutenant Dove. And then you've had testimony from Agent Van Houten, who received that phone and analyzed it and then delivered that back to Lieutenant Dove. And Lieutenant Dove is going to be here to complete that chain. So if you look at the case law, and we do have some cases prepared if you need them. Where's the copies of those, please, Your Honor? This is not fungible evidence. In the case case law is very clear, Your Honor, that chain, you don't have to call every single person that touched the evidence throughout the way, that it only needs to be established as much as is practicable. And I think we've done that in great detail. And any
ethical question, is it fungible or non-fungible? Is a cell phone fungible or non-fungible?
If you look at the exterior, it's fungible. You can't tell one iPhone 11 from any other one until you open it, okay? But is the phone that was found at Paul, is that the same phone? And that's why you have the chain. It was cracked open and they got the material from, they want Doug to analyze. It is, this is an iPhone 11, Your Honor. It's not Paul's.
And Your Honor, again.
Fungible or non-fungible?
I'd say that it's not fungible, Your Honor. And again, I think we've had, it's clearly not fungible. And there's
clearly
been.
Clearly not fungible. And you say clearly, what do you mean?
Well,
generally, when things are clear, then we don't have a debate.
Fair enough. That's a good point. I strenuously object, Your Honor. I apologize. But anyway, Your Honor, you know, when you look at something like cell phone evidence and you look at the class of types of evidence that are clearly fungible, those two are I think, different in the manner in which they exist and the manner in which they are. And I'm not aware of any case that's ever held a cell phone as to be fungible. It is a physical item. Additionally, this particular one, I'm sorry, John, what does that say? And additionally, this particular cell phone has a serial number and an IMEI that is specifically identifiable. The cell phones are not fungible. They are specific. They have specific identifying information like that. And so, again, I think that given the weight of that and the weight of what we have established, we more than established the chain.
No. Chain of custody. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize. Your Honor, I'd note on this chain of custody, there's no serial number, there's no IME number, there's nothing on these documents. I'd be happy to, it's State's Exhibit 298 and 299. There's nothing on these indicating. It's just self. Matter of fact, the description is Paul's cell phone. There's no identifying data on this whatsoever. And by the way, I think we've been sort of lax. We should have asked all these witnesses how they know it was this cell phone. They never testified to serial numbers. That's water over the dam, under the bridge. But perhaps I should have asked that.
Well, and again, Your Honor, these came in without objection associated with testimony about that specific phone that people like McManigle and Agent Van Houten have specifically identified as associated with these chain sheets and with that specific phone. So again, I think that's a specific identification and they are not fungible in that regard.
Again, the cases that you said you have,
Your Honor, and I've got a copy right here. This isn't specifically, may I hand it up to Your Honor?
Yes. Sorry. Tell me about the case. State v. Pulley, yes, sir.
All right. And again, this is just a general, this isn't related to cell phones in specific, but it does talk about, establishing the chain of custody as far as practicable. And again, it talks about where the evidence establishes the identity of those who have handled the evidence and reasonably demonstrates the manner of handling of the evidence, which we've had testimony as to both of those. Our courts have been willing to fill in gaps in the chain of custody due to an absent witness. Proof of the chain of custody need not negate all possibility of tampering so long as the chain of possession is complete. It goes on, Your Honor, and that, I apologize, that was from head notes 5, 4, 5, and 6. It goes on to talk about a perfect chain of custody is not required. I think the evidence here on the whole has been more than sufficient to establish the chain. And additionally, even beyond that, I think that none of that precludes Lieutenant Dove to testifying about, given the foundation that's been laid, to testifying about the contents of that extraction pending, any additional witnesses that will come in. I don't think that's precluded at this time either. He can still go forward and testify as to the extent of his testimony about that extraction, and certainly understanding that that any additional witnesses, are still forthcoming. So I don't think that precludes him from testifying as to the contents of that extraction.
Your Honor, with all due respect to the Attorney General, the footnote says when establishing chain, head note four, when establishing chain of custody of fungible, bolded evidence where multiple people have handled or analyzed the substance, the identity of the individuals who acquired the evidence and what was done with the evidence between the taking and the analysis must not be left to conjecture. And there's nothing in any document we've heard or any witness that is specifically identified that I got cell phone M4381 and gave it to somebody else who says I got that same cell phone because it had the same serial number. If that's not conjecture, I don't know what is. And again, what's the big hurdle here? He's got three people he needs to call. Unless there's a problem with one of them, to sign this document that didn't have it. And I think that this is an important piece of evidence. And we ought to just require what's required by this case and every other case where there's a fungible item.
Your Honor, again, going back to Head Notes 4 and 5, testimony from each custodian of fungible evidence, however, is not a prerequisite to establishing a chain of custody. Again, we've had testimony about collection, we've had testimony about the manner of collection, and we've had testimony from those who actually analyzed it in the interim to get to Lieutenant Dove, who will then complete that analysis. So we've got testimony about collection, we've got chain sheets supporting that, and then we'll have every person who actually analyzed it. And I think that's more than sufficient chain to establish its admissibility at this time.
Anything further? Last word.
Nothing from the state, Your Honor.
Nothing from the defense.
All right. To the extent that this is a motion to exclude this testimony, the motion is denied. I do not believe that the portion of this case that State v. Pulley that says the the identity of individuals who acquired the evidence and what was done with the evidence between the taking and the analysis must not be left to conjecture. I believe that a cell phone is not a fungible item, but it is complicated to the degree that there is analysis. There was analysis done with the cell phone, but the testimony, particularly the testimony of Van Houten, sufficiently establishes that this phone was not tampered with, could not be tampered with, and I believe that the state has sufficiently established a chain. Cases have held that a perfect chain is not necessary, and I believe the state has sufficiently established the chain of custody to the degree necessary that the next witness can testify. So I deny the motion, and the objection is noted for the record.
Your Honor, make sure the record. Please, all due respect, we accept her.
I said it's noted for the record, yes.
From the old school, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir. Bring the jury.
Your Honor, to be clear, we do have one
Thank you. Your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state would call John Bedingfield.
Please, your right hand, left hand on the side. Do you affirm the testimony you're about to give the court of this trial shall be the truth, so help you God?
I do.
So the seat in the witness stand. State your name again for this. For the record, spell your last name, please.
John Bedingfield, Bedingfield.
Mr. Bedingfield, how are you doing today?
Doing good.
All right. Tell us where you live.
Barnwell.
All right. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Grew up there or?
Grew up there, born and raised in Barnwell. Worked there my entire career, 28 years with the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay.
Still and live in Barnwell.
Where do you work now?
I'm the Region 3 captain, which is the Midlands region, Lake Murray, Lake Marion.
Okay. And is that a law enforcement position?
Yes, sir, it is.
Are you a Class 1 officer?
I am.
And you said you've been with DNR how long?
28 years.
Has that been the extent of your law enforcement career?
Yes, sir.
Are you still employed there?
Yes, sir.
Do you have any other businesses or any other economic stuff you're associated with?
I do. Back in 2016, I got a federal firearms license to sell and manufacture firearms.
All right. And tell me how you got into that. What led you to develop that? Is that like a side business?
Side business. It's just a passion I had of working on guns and building guns. Decided to turn it into business.
All right. And you mentioned a federal firearms license. Is that what people know as an FFL?
Yes, sir.
All right. Just tell me very quickly what it takes. What does it mean to have an FFL?
It means you can transfer firearms to individuals. You do a background check. Upon that sale or transfer.
Okay. If you're engaged in sort of the commercial sale of firearms or as a business, do you need an FFL to do that?
Yes, sir.
All right, and that's different from private sales back and forth, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And with an FFL, does it come with an obligation to keep certain paperwork with regard to the firearms that you're involved in selling?
Yes, sir, it does.
And explain to me some of the paperwork that you have to get and some of the paperwork you have to keep when you're selling firearms with an FFL.
When a firearm comes in to me, it gets logged into a log. Upon its sale or transfer out, it gets logged out with the 4473 background check.
All right, and tell me what the 4473 is, please.
It's person's personal information, gun information. It gets called into the ATF, and it gets approved or disapproved for transfer to that individual.
Is that like a federal form?
Is there instant background check? Yes, sir.
Like every federal form has got a number on it?
Yep.
And that's what?
4473.
4473? Is that the one we have to check the form saying, I'm not a drug user, and I'm not a part of a terrorist organization, and all
yes,
that
sir.
Stuff? Yes, sir. All right. But you have to ensure that those are filled out with people that you have formed.
Yes, sir.
Sell firearms to, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
What type of firearms are you selling? I mean, are you manufacturing from scratch, or how do you do that?
Early on, I did. Wasn't lucrative enough, so I was just buying and selling.
Right.
So I would buy a gun, configure it, or buy parts, configure it as an individual wanted, and provide it to them.
Okay. And so where would you buy parts from? What's a big source of parts?
I've had numerous, but primarily Palmetto State Armory for AR-15 parts, but I've used 20 or 30 other vendors throughout the course of me having the license.
When people think about an AR-15 style weapon, can that just fire like one caliber of bullet, or can multiple calibers of bullets be configured with an AR-15 style weapon?
As long as they're compatible with the magazine system and the bolt carrier, many different calibers can be configured.
Like what? What's the most common AR-15 calibers?
.223, .556, which are more or less interchangeable. .300 Blackout, .65 Grendel.
Okay. All right. And the most common one you said was .223 and .556?
Yes, sir.
All right. And then .300 Blackout is one you mentioned.
Yes, sir.
All right. Let me ask you this. Are you at all related to the defendant, Alec Murdaugh?
I am.
All right. And what's the relation?
Our grandmothers were sisters. We're grown up with the Murdochs as cousins.
All right, so you've known him your entire life or a
yes.
long time? Okay. At any point in time, did the defendant, Alec Murdaugh, approach you about perhaps assembling or making some firearms for him?
He did.
All right, and do you remember roughly when that was?
Would have been around Christmas of 16.
Okay, and what was your conversation with the defendant over there about what he wanted you to put together?
He was looking for a couple of guns for the boys to hunt pigs with.
Okay. And did y'all have a discussion about what type of gun, what caliber, and that sort of thing?
We did. I kind of steered him towards the 300 blackout just because of its effectiveness on hogs versus a 223 or 556.
All right. And just very quickly, between a blackout and a 223 or 556, why did you suggest a blackout as a more effective round than those?
Larger caliber, larger diameter bullet, a little more knockdown power for pigs. A 223 at that time, there weren't many larger or heavier grain bullets that were effective.
All right. So you suggested the blackout. Did he agree to that?
He did.
And again, he wanted these for the boys to hunt pigs.
That's right.
Or hogs. All right. Was there a particular holiday coming up that he wanted them for?
It would have been Christmas of that 16 Christmas.
2016? Okay. Did you ultimately assemble some firearms for him?
I did.
All right. And tell us, describe those firearms for us, how they were configured, what was on them. Give us some detail about them, please.
Initial conversation, and part of why the 300 Blackout was chosen was its ability to shoot subsonic ammo, and we had talked about possibly some suppressors for the same guns.
Let me slow you down real quick. Tell the jury what a suppressor is.
A silencer or a sound suppression device for a firearm.
So a subsonic round, you have to have a subsonic round for the suppressor to work. Is that
efficient? It makes it most efficient.
Okay. All right. Keep going if you would, please.
That was kind of where I steered that way, but it was a pair of Palmetto State Armory lowers that I built some 300 Blackout uppers for, and one was configured in all black as he requested, and the other was Cerakoted, which is a paint finish, a ceramic paint finish, in a tan.
Okay. And when you say Cerakote, is that a service or that you're providing?
It does. It is, yes.
All right. And just very quickly, tell the jury what you mean by that. What is Cerakoting?
It's a refinishing. It's a paint job on a firearm. A lot of items can be Cerakoted, plastic, wood, whatever. But you blast the finish, original finish, degrease it, put a two-part finish on, and bake it on. It's a coloring.
So the black one you don't have to treat.
So I'm sorry.
The black one you didn't have to treat, like.
Correct.
But the tan one you had to Cerakote.
Yes, sir.
Did the defendant request any sort of optics or scope on these guns?
Did. We put a pair of ATN thermal scopes on the rifles.
And what specifically, why are the thermal scopes good for hunting hogs, or why were they put on there?
Hog hunting in South Carolina is legal to hunt at night, mm-hmm. With the proper permitting, and it allows you to night hunt the pigs.
All right, Mr. Gutfield, I'm going to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 302 for identification at this time and see if you recognize that image right there.
I do.
All right, and tell me what that is.
Those are the two 300 Blackout rifles I sold at.
All right, those are the exact two in Christmas. Is that correct?
Yes.
Christmas of 2016?
The original two, yes, sir.
Okay. And, all right, let me, Your Honor, this time I would move stakes 302 in the evidence, please.
Good.
All right. Let me put this on the Elmo real quick. All right, can you see that on your screen there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And just real quick, if we look down at the end of the barrel on these, what are those things right there?
Those would be the suppressors.
All right. And tell me about this image. How do you recognize this image? What was going on when this image was taken?
That was the day I took the guns to Alec. I showed him, that's how I presented them to him. Again, the suppressors are still in my possession. We never did the paperwork on the suppressors.
And let's unpack that a little bit. Where did you take those guns to him, do you recall?
His office.
All right. And they're in some sort of case. Do you recall that case?
Yes, sir. That's my hard case.
All right. So you brought him in that case?
Yes, sir.
Did you leave the case with him, or did you take that back with you?
I have the case.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that we see the suppressors are on there. Did you ever deliver those suppressors to Alec Murdoch?
I did not.
All right. Now, explain that to the jury. Why were you unable to do that?
To possess an NFA item, a National Firearms Act restricted item, where the federal government restricted the possession of short-barreled rifles, machine guns, suppressors, and short-barrel shotguns, you have to apply for a tax stamp through the federal government. It's a background check system that allows for the possession once you pass the background check.
Okay. And had Alec completed that additional paperwork?
No, we never completed it.
Is that for the suppressor, is that additional paperwork in addition to what it takes to normally get the rifle?
Yes.
Okay. What was y'all's discussion, if any, about that paperwork and completing it and all the rest of it?
We had some random discussions. I'd egg him from time to time, hey, man, let's get the paperwork going. And he was going to put them in a trust, which was an entity which would own the items. And we never got it all put together.
Because of the special legality about suppressors, is it common for people to set up a trust, a legal trust, that actually owns those suppressors?
Yes, it is.
And that was the paperwork that needed to be completed?
That and the application side of it, but that was the biggest portion.
He was like, I'm going to get back to you, I'll do it, and just never did. Did he pay for those suppressors?
He did.
All right. He just never received them?
Correct.
Where are those suppressors to this day?
They're in my inventory at my business.
Okay. At some point in time, did you ever have another conversation with Alec about making another blackout?
I did.
And when roughly was that? Do you recall?
It would have been around April of 2018.
April of 2018. All right. And what did Alec tell you? What was your conversation with him about making a third blackout?
That Paul had lost or misplaced his rifle and he wanted to replace it.
Okay. And did you ultimately make him a third blackout?
I did.
Did this particular rifle, did you put any optic on it?
I did not.
All right. Did Alec say, don't put an optic on it because they already lost the other one?
Yes.
Those optics are fairly expensive?
They can be, yes, sir.
All right. And roughly how much were the thermal optics that we see on this particular picture that's on the screen, the exhibit I previously had admitted?
$1,500 to $1,800 each.
All right. So the third one did not have an optic on it?
Correct. All
right. And did you ultimately provide that weapon?
I did.
All right. Well, tell me how you provided that. Did Alec pick it up or did somebody else pick it up?
He did not. When I let him know it was ready, he said he was unavailable and Maggie would come pick it up.
Okay. And is that what happened?
It is.
All right. And so tell me about that. Tell me about your interaction with Maggie when she picked that weapon up.
She came to town. We met, did some paperwork, and she handed me a check and drove back to Hampton.
And you gave the weapon, the third weapon?
Yep. She would have completed the 4473 with me.
All right. So you made three blackouts, excluding the optic, roughly in the same configuration. Maggie picked up that third one, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Let me show you some exhibits real quick. So, yeah. Show you what's been marked, previously marked for identification with States 247, and I'm going to have you flip through those and just first tell me generally if you recognize the documents in States 247.
I do.
All right, tell me what those are.
The first would be the original check from Alec for the first two firearms, cancel check to me. Second would have been the third from Maggie, cancel check to me. The third and fourth page would be the firearm log.
We'll talk more about that in a minute, but that's part of your firearm log, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
All right, and then I'm going to show you what's been marked as, hold on, I'm going to staple this. I'm going to show you what's been marked as States 245 and see if you recognize this document.
I do.
All right, tell me what that is.
It is the original 4473 from the first two firearms to Alec.
All right, let me see this back real quick. Your Honor, this time we would move to States 245 and 247 into evidence.
Okay. Admitted.
All right. Put these up on the screen. All right, this is States Exhibit 247,
And we're looking now at the first page. Describe to the jury what that is, please.
That is a canceled check from Elliott for the original two firearms.
For the original two?
Yes, sir.
And what's the price on that, please? I can bring it to you if you can.
I got it. $9,188.
All right. And what's the date on that, please?
I'm sorry?
What's the date on that?
12/23/16.
Right. And this is this a record that you kept in accordance with your FFL obligations?
The check, no, sir. We retrieved that from my bank.
Gotcha. All right. Go to the second page of this exhibit. You recognize that. Tell me what that is, please.
That is the check for the third replacement 300 blackout to Maggie Murdoch. That's the check she wrote to me.
All right. And what's the amount on that one?
$875.
All right, so the first one for two of them was $9,188, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the second one is only $875, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And is the difference between those that the second one didn't have the optic and didn't have the suppressor?
Sling.
Is that part of the difference?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, before we get to the rest of that exhibit, let me go to 245. And I'm going to show you this. This is what now?
That is the 4473 for the first two 300 blackouts.
All right. And if we see down here little letters that says form 4473, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And these are all the questions that you have to answer to buy a firearm?
Correct.
Okay. And whose name do we have on this?
Richard Alexander Murdoch.
All right. And then right here, what are these two things right there?
That would be the serial numbers from each of the firearms.
All right. And let me ask you this real quick. With an AR-style platform, is every part of it serialized, have a serial number, or if not, what parts are?
Only the lower receiver is serialized.
All right. And you talk about the lower receiver. Let me take this back up. Point to me what we're talking about on this picture.
This portion of the firearm.
Okay. And I'm going to put it back on the screen. I'm going to point to what you just did and tell me you got it right.
Okay.
All right. So this portion right here is the lower receiver?
Yes, sir.
And that's the serialized portion, correct?
Correct.
All right. And finally down here, what do we have right there?
The date.
All right. And what's the date on that?
January 10th, 2017.
After these murders happened, did you ever get a call from SLED agent Jeff Croft?
I did.
Is that somebody you knew prior to this?
Yes.
Knowing him from growing up in Barnwell or living in Barnwell?
Through my law enforcement career, him at the county and our kids were in school together.
Did you have a conversation with Jeff Croft?
Yes.
Did Jeff Croft ask you to provide him anything?
He did.
And what did he ask you to provide him?
The paperwork you've just submitted, the 4473 and the canceled checks.
Right. When you initially responded, did you send him the paperwork for all three blackouts that you made for the defendant?
Or not initially, I don't think so. I don't recall exactly.
Just the first two?
The first two, yes, sir.
All right. And did you have a subsequent conversation with him some point later in time?
Yes.
And what was the nature of that conversation?
There was a third, and through an audit, I was able to backtrack and provide what I did on the third.
All right. So there was an inquiry made as to where there was a third one, and you said, yes, there was a third one.
Correct.
Do you have all your paperwork for that third one?
No, sir. The 4473 is unaccounted for.
All right. So you went back looking, and you couldn't find it?
Correct.
All right. Did you make any efforts, though, to determine which one that gun must have been?
Well, based on the canceled check, the date of it, and the only missing exit from my log, it would have been 111, I believe. Is that it?
All right. I'm going to take you back, Exhibit 247, and have you look at the last two pages of that exhibit, and explain to me what you're talking about.
So each firearm that comes in is numbered and described. It's a receipt and disposition form.
Mm-hmm. And what was different about 111?
It was blank.
Okay.
So did you do some process of elimination here?
I did.
You looked at the date of that check in April of 2018 for the third blackout?
Correct, yes, sir.
And looked in your log, and this was the one that didn't have any other information?
Only one of the of many years that it could have even been.
All right. I'm going to put this up on the screen. And is this 111 right there that you're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then we go over to the second page. And if they were laying next to each other, it's like a logbook?
Correct.
And if these pages were laying next to each other, this was the blank one, correct?
Yes, sir.
After you received that second communication with Jeff Croft, did you provide him that log paperwork that we just looked at?
Yes, sir.
Have you amended your federal firearms license forms to reflect that now?
Yes. Yes. It was a missing form. I reflected it that it was sold to Maggie Murder on 4/14/2018.
All right. How many blackouts, AR-style rifles, did you make for Alec Murder?
Three.
And when was that last one made?
2018.
April?
April of 2018.
Right. Hold on 1 second. All right. Thank you, Mr. Benfield. Answer any questions the defense may have, please.
Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Benfield. My name is Jim Griffin. I represent Alec Murdoch. The can I have Elmo back? Did I lose Elmo? No, I just need Elmo activated. No, I don't have Elmo. Did they turn Elmo on?
Still on.
Elmo's still on. Thank you. It is. Mr. Bedingfield, these were the 200-300 blackouts that were sold to Alec for Christmas in 2016, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And one was black and one was tan, right?
Correct.
And do you know which gun went to which son?
I don't recall.
All right, and then you built a replacement 300 blackout sometime, I believe you said in 2018, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, sir.
And was that a tan one or a black one?
It would have been black.
Excuse me?
It was black.
So
the third one, I'm sorry, was black.
The third one was black?
Yes, sir.
So if the tan one was lost in this, then Mr. Murdoch would have had, or his boys would have had, two black, 300 blackouts.
Yes, sir, I assume so.
After 2018. Okay. Now, the original price was $9,188 for the two firearms that they, Buster and Paul, got for Christmas in 2016, correct?
Yes, sir.
And that included the cost of the basic weapon, the AR, modified AR to 300 blackout, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then it included the cost of the thermal night scope.
Yes, sir.
And you said that's about $1,500 each?
I'm guessing at that, but yes, sir.
Okay. And then so that's like $3,000 for two, ballparking, right? And then the suppressors, how much are the suppressors?
They typically, I don't remember on those, but they around $1,000 apiece.
So that's another $2,000. So, but Mr. Murdoch never took possession of the suppressors because it required some trust or some
more paperwork.
More paperwork. Okay. And the but now the replacement that was purchased in 2018 was only $875. Did you build the replacement?
Yes, sir.
Did the price go down in 2018?
Well, the lack of accessories and the Cerakoting was included in that as well. Slings on this rifle, on the ones we're looking at here, were included in the first one.
So a stripped down model of the, well, was the replacement 2018 just stripped down model as basic as you could buy?
Pretty much, yes, sir. Similar configuration. As far as I remember, it was a free-floated 16-inch 300 blackout. Okay.
And you assembled the ones in 2016 and the one in 2018, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And did you get the component parts from Palmetto State Armory?
I'm not sure exactly where they would have come from. The lower receiver would have been, yes, sir, but the upper components, I would source those out from different vendors. I'm not sure where they would have come from.
And when you, let me ask you about the, I guess, the ejector. You know what that is?
Ejector? Yes, sir.
And is that upper portion, lower portion?
Upper.
And is it housed in a, well, do you put the ejectors in separately, or does that come?
In a bulk carrier group. They would be already preassembled in a bulk carrier group.
Okay. And do you know where you bought the ejectors for the 2016?
No, sir.
Do you know where you bought the ejectors for the 2018?
No, sir.
Okay. Do you keep ejectors in stock?
I wouldn't. No, sir. They would typically be already preassembled in the bulk carrier groups on AR-15 style guns.
Right. But do you buy in bulk the preassembled
bulk carrier? No, sir. As someone requests something, I'll source it out, see where I can find it, and build it. Order parts to put together.
Are 300 blackouts sold without having to have someone like yourself build it?
Yes.
Okay, and who carries 300 blackout if I wanted to leave here, go buy one this afternoon? I mean,
the most common in the state of South Carolina is Palmetto State Armory.
So they assemble
them? I was a dealer for them, and I was buying parts for them on a lot of builds as well.
And how long have you been selling or building 300 blackouts?
I've been in the business since 2016, so there's a lot of other guns I've built as well.
And this list that you had, I'm not going to go through it, but it is Exhibit 247. I'll just put it up on Elmo. All right, quick. So I don't mess it up. Thanks. And we don't need to publish anybody's name there, but are all those 300 blackouts or just various?
Various. 45 caliber 9mm multi for the lower, 410 shotguns, 243 rifles.
Okay. Take that off. The and you said these are used and that you recommended these 300 blackouts be used for hog hunting?
Yes, sir.
And is that, in this part of the state, are wild hogs kind of a nuisance to game management, property management?
A severe nuisance, yes, sir.
And explain that, please, sir.
They do a tremendous amount of damage to property and crops in this part of the state.
How so?
They root, as pigs do, they root up crops and woodlands and yards. They're very destructive.
And is that a common problem throughout the Lowcountry?
Yes, sir.
And have you recommended a number of to a number of customers to 300 blackout to root out the nuisance?
Yes,
hogs.
I have.
Do you have any estimate how many 300 blackouts you've sold over the last 4 or 5 years?
No, sir. I wouldn't. I've a little over 600 firearm transfers. I wouldn't know.
You think it's more than 100?
I don't know. It's a lot, but I don't know how many.
All right. Okay. You mentioned that you and Alec Murdoch are related. Is that
yes,
right?
Sir.
How are you related?
Our grandmothers were sisters.
Okay, and does that make and your?
I call us second cousins. We're cousins.
Your fathers were first cousins, right?
Correct.
Okay. And you spend, over the years, you spend time with Alec and the boys?
I have. Not a lot with Alec, mostly with John Marvin.
And you go, have you been camping with Alec and the boys? I think that'd be Dad used to host a big camp every year?
I have.
And you been fishing with him?
Not much.
Been hunting with him?
No, sir, not Alec.
Okay.
I have with John.
Right. You've known Alec for quite some time?
My entire life.
Are you, well, a gift of some $8,000 is a pretty nice gift for two boys, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you ever observe Alec around his sons? What kind of relationship they had?
I have.
And how would you describe their relationship?
It was always good. I mean, when he called me, he was excited about getting these for his boys.
And it was a big Christmas for them.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. 1 second, Ron. Is it less expensive to buy a 300 Blackout directly from Palmetto State Armory rather than have you build one?
It can be, depending on configuration.
And all the...
any accessories that get added. And...
okay. All right, that's all the questions I have, Your Honor.
Very quickly, Your Honor.
You mentioned that one of the services that you provide is the Cerakoting on the tan one. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And that's kind of a painting process, painting and then bake it. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And if someone has a gun, and is it just tan you Cerakote it, or are there multiple colors you can potentially
Cerakote? Multiple colors.
Multiple colors. So if you want to customize your firearm, you can take it to somebody and get them to Cerakote it.
Yes, sir.
And I can have a gun I've owned for 10 years, and I decide that I want to get it Cerakoted, and I can take it to somebody who can put it in the color that I desire.
Yes, sir.
It doesn't have to happen right at the beginning.
No.
Okay. All right. And looking at right here on page... the third page of State's Exhibit 247, we have right here multiple calibers of gauge. Is that correct? We have caliber of gauge listed. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And we have a number of different ones right here. That's 45?
Yes, sir.
Is that 45 ACP?
Colt 9, yes, sir.
All right. 9, is that 9 millimeter?
Yes, sir.
All right. And then we have... what does that say right there?
Multi. Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
The lower receivers are stamped multi-caliber when they're sold as bare receivers.
14, caliber. That's a shotgun round?
Yes, sir.
All right. 243, that would be?
A 243 center fire rifle.
All right. 223 right there?
Yes, sir.
And a 9mm right there?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you're in the business of assembling multiple different calibers. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but most of what is on this page are entire firearms that were shipped to me.
Gotcha. All right.
Stand by for me. 1 second.
All right. Nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you, sir. Call your next witness.
State calls Lieutenant Britt Dove for SLED.
I do.
State your name again as you took the witness to me. Spell your last name for the record, please.
Britt Dove, D-O-V-E. I go by Britt. I'm known as David Britton Dove.
Okay. And Lieutenant Dove, where are you currently employed, sir?
For the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, known as SLED, and the Computer Crime Center.
Right. And what's your rank?
I am a lieutenant in the unit.
So you're in a supervisor capacity over the Computer Crimes Unit?
Yes, sir, I am.
Right. How long have you worked at SLED?
I began my career at SLED in June of 2008.
Right. And did you have law enforcement experience prior to working with SLED?
Yes, sir, I did. I began my law enforcement career in December of 1999 with the West Columbia Police Department. I served as a patrol officer and a school resource officer with them. I also served was with the Richland County Sheriff's Department for several years as a resource officer. And then I came back to West Columbia as an investigator handling family violence, elder abuse, child abuse, sexual assault investigations before coming to SLED.
And since you've been in SLED, I believe you, did you just say it was 2008 when you started SLED?
Yes, sir.
What have you, roles have you filled at SLED since 2008?
When I began at SLED, I began as the undercover chat specialist dealing with internet crimes against children and also doing digital forensics, whether it be computers, cell phones, tablets, at the time GPS systems. From there, I moved into the role of working with file-to-file trading of child pornography and dealt with that. And then from there, I moved into the role of doing general investigations while continuing to do digital forensics before I became a supervisor.
All right, and you're a supervisor of computer crimes, is that correct?
Yes, sir, I am.
And just briefly, what exactly does computer crimes do at SLED?
Computer crimes at SLED, they do several things. One, when local agencies submit digital evidence to us, whether it be a laptop, a tower, tablet, DVR, cell phone, servers, we will go and try to extract the information to look for anything that's relevant to the investigation. We also do handle some investigations. We also do internet and other kind of investigations, along with doing intrusion investigations on servers and ransomware.
Okay. Now, you've talked a little bit about computer and phone forensics, and that's something you have experience in, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Give the jury a brief description, and we'll get into more details later as we go through some of the evidence, but what is computer forensics and what is phone forensics and how are they different?
Computer forensics, when we receive a computer, whether it be a laptop or a tower, it's going to be treated the same way. We're going to attempt to remove the hard drive from it, connect the hard drive to a physical write blocker, which is a piece of hardware that we connect it to. We also use a software write blocker. That way we can extract the information and get a bit-by-bit forensic copy of all the addressable area on the drive. And then that way, that's what we work off of, is that copy, so that we can then do not disturb the original evidence when we're looking to see what's on there. Cell phone forensics are a little bit different. You can't remove necessarily, especially with the newer ones, you can't go and remove a hard drive from the cell phone. So many times what we have to do is connect the cell phone to hardware devices, whether it be Cellebrite, GrayKey, Axiom, or one of the other ones out there. Once we connect it, then we will extract the information from that and then work off that information that's extracted from that in order to do the examinations.
Okay. All right. And have you had training over the years in computer and phone forensics?
Yes, sir, I have.
Right. Can you briefly describe to the jury some of the training you've had?
Yes, sir. If I may refer to my notes. I am currently a certified Cellebrite operator. I'm a Cellebrite certified physical analyst. I'm certified in advanced smartphone analyst with Cellebrite. I'm certified with used to be Black Bag Mobilize operator. I'm certified as a black light examiner, and I've also received certification for Axon investigative certified operator and examiner. I'm currently a member of the Secret Service Task Force. I'm also a member of the FBI Cyber Working Task Force and also the FBI InfraGuard, along with the South Carolina Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. I've received training from Cellebrite to receive these certifications and been tested on those. I've also received training with the National White Collar Crime Center for basic data recovery and acquisition, identifying and seizing electronic evidence, encryption, metadata, and EXIF tags, electronic law enforcement seminars, basic computer skills for law enforcement, network intrusion response program, introduction to cell phone investigations, virtual currency, blockchain tracing, and cryptocurrency anti-money laundering, and the future of preserving digital evidence. I've also attended the National Computer Forensic Institute with the Secret Service and received training in the basic computer evidence recovery, basic network investigative training, point of sale training, advanced forensics training, network intrusion response program, digital evidence investigations, MAC forensics training. I've also received training from Access Data, also known as FTK, and Internet Forensics. I've received training from Texas A&M, their School of Engineering Extension Services through FEMA for forensic or digital forensics basics, network assurance, information security for everyone, cyber incident analyst and response. Also received training from HIDA courses, Atlanta, Carolinas, the social media resource investigations. Black bag as technology, where I received training to become a certified mobilized operator. Also with basic technology for autopsy, 8-hour online training, which is a forensic tool to use for computers. Intro to DFER, the divide and conquer process. I've attended Magnet Forensics virtual summits for pattern of life analysis, timeline user generated activities, virtual summit taking a bite out of a Chromebook analyst, virtual summit taking the first steps into Windows and memory forensics, virtual summit the evolution of ransomware, attack, investigation, response, and prevention services. That's just to name a few. I have several more pages of them if you'd like me to read them.
I think that should be sufficient for now, anyway. Have you been qualified as an expert in court before?
Yes, sir, I have.
In what areas?
I've been qualified as a computer forensic expert and also as a cell phone forensic expert.
All right. Approximately how many times have you been qualified
in court? 6 times total.
All right. Your Honor, at this time, the state would seek to introduce Lieutenant Dove as an expert in cell phone forensics.
As a defense. No objection, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen, he is so qualified as an expert in the field of cell phone forensics. You may proceed.
Thank you. All right, Lieutenant Duff, a few minutes ago you briefly kind of discussed the process of extracting data from cell phones. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
Right, let's get into a little more detail of that process. First of all, when you receive a cell phone, in a locked state, are you able to access the files on that phone?
No, sir. We're not able to access all the files on there.
Why is that?
Because with modern cell phones, when they are in a locked state, the files are encrypted on there. They usually use 256-bit encryption, and they're based with the Apple phone, for instance, they're based at a file-level encryption so that you are not able to pull the file out and look at it until you decrypt it or unlock the file.
All right. And once the phone is unlocked, you're then able to access the data, correct?
Yes, sir, we are.
What is a phone extraction, first of all, and then what's a phone extraction?
A phone extraction would be us retrieving as much information, user information, off of that phone as possible. And then once we take that information, it's put into, depending on the software, a lot of times it's put into a zip file. And then we'll process that zip file with another piece of software to go through and decode and look at the information.
Okay. And what kinds of information can you get from a phone via an extraction?
There are several different types of extractions. One is an advanced logical extraction, which is kind of the surface level, what you would see on your phone if you looked at it. Then you have full file system extractions that go deeper, which will get hidden files that you may not see, like databases in there that are running in the background, which you won't see, but yet it contains information. And then the ultimate is a physical extraction. Now, physical extraction involves things whether you're going to root a phone or you're going to jailbreak a phone. And what that means is, basically, I'm going in and removing all security features from your phone, so that now it's wide open and something could happen to it, which we don't practice rooting or jailbreaking phones because it is a huge security risk for the owner.
And I think you kind of mentioned this, but there are different types of phone extractions, correct?
Yes, sir, there is.
And just name a few of them.
There's the advanced logical extraction, like I described, it's just kind of the surface level that you go through. It's what you see on your phone. If you look at it, you see the text messages, call logs, pictures, things like that. Then you have the file system, which are going to get you databases in there. They're going to get you things that you're not seeing, along with the surface level. And then, of course, you have the physical, which ultimately gives you programming ability to the phone.
So there's three general categories or types of extractions. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. And imagine in doing this in your computer lab, you have access to multiple types of software to help you extract and process this data off these phones. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, we do.
All right. And what's some of the software you use to help you with these phones?
Some of the software we use, we'll use Cellebrite, whether it's their UFED Touch, which is a hardware device to extract information. They have a 4PC version, which is it sits on your laptop or your computer. We'll use that to extract. There's also Axon by Magnet Forensics that we'll use to extract stuff too. And then Cellebrite also offers several other things. The one we'll use a lot is GrayKey, which we use to extract information from iOS devices or from Android devices.
Okay. And how do you decide what software to use on what device?
It really depends on what we're looking for and the state of the device when we receive it. If we receive a phone that we have a passcode to that's they're just looking for call logs and pictures, the investigator, sometimes we'll just use Cellebrite for PC or physical analyzer, and we'll just do advanced logical extraction for them. Most of the time, though, we always try to get a full file system because there's additional stuff we can see and look at besides just that surface level stuff. So if it's an iOS, an Android, sometimes we'll use GrayKey. If it's one of the other ones, sometimes we'll reach out to the Secret Service if we're not able to and use Cellebrite Premium.
And we'll talk in more detail about each phone later, but in terms of your testimony today, we're going to focus on three different phones, and that's Maggie's, Alex's, and Paul's. And you've been able to process all those phones in your lab, is that correct?
Yes, sir, I was.
Just for Maggie's phone, what types of software did you use to process her phone?
For Maggie's phone, I used several different softwares. I did the extraction with GrayKey in order to get the full file system, like I described. That way it gets more of the databases, more of the surface level stuff. From that, I used Cellebrite Physical Analyzer to go in and do the decoding and to analyze and look at the phone and the information on there. I also used Axon by Magnet Forensics. I used their tool to help validate what I was seeing with the Cellebrite stuff.
And why do you use the three different types of software in this? Why did you use three different types of software on Maggie's phone?
GrayKey is primarily just an extraction device. Okay. It's a piece of hardware like a box that you would connect to, and it helps extract the information. It doesn't do any of the decoding or any of the analyzing of it. I used Cellebrite Physical Analyzer to go through to decode into the analyzing. What I was finding on that, I wanted to validate that what I was seeing was being decoded properly and was right, so I ran through a separate piece of software so that I could see, and if it's getting the same information, then I know that both are decoding properly.
So, for example, if you find a particular text or photo that has a certain timestamp on using Cellebrite, you want to check on Axiom to see if it has the same timestamp. Is that something you'd look for?
Yes, sir. Correct.
And what would that tell you if you saw they had the same timestamp?
If it told me they had the same thing, they would have validated each other, that both were working properly and decoding the information properly.
All right. All right. And you received a phone that's been identified, that you identified as Alex's phone. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
And we'll get into the details of you receiving it a little later. What pieces of software did you use to analyze Alex's phone?
Alex's phone, I used GrayKey to do the full file system extraction. At first, I didn't have the password for that phone, and then I was able to obtain that password. So I used it to the full file system, and then I ran it through Cellebrite Physical Analyzer, and then turned around and used Axon to validate my results to make sure they were decoding properly.
Okay. And Paul's phone, which you've had an opportunity to process as well, correct?
When I received Paul's phone, it had a locked passcode that I was not able to bypass with GrayKey. At the time, the software version that was running on the phone, the model of phone, it would not get a full file system and would not obtain the passcode. So I reached out to the Secret Service because they had additional resources to see if we could use their resources to obtain the passcode and the extraction.
And ultimately that was successful, correct?
Yes, sir, it was.
And that was John Van Outen with the Secret Service?
Yes, sir. That was my point of contact. That's who I took the phone to and signed over to. And then I received the phone back along with a hard drive containing the extraction he had performed.
All right. And circling back to Maggie and Alex's phone, you provided passcodes for those two phones, is that correct?
Originally, I was provided a passcode for Maggie's phone. Mm-hmm. For Alex's phone, I received two phones at the same time on that case, or within a day or two apart. One was from him, had a passcode. The other one did not have a passcode with it. Mm-hmm. But I attempted, because we were creatures of habit, to use the same passcode on both, and it worked.
Okay. All right. Let's, you've already referenced this, but let's go back and talk about the kinds of information you pull off these phones. And there's user-accessible information that would normally be accessible by a user of the phone, correct?
Yes, sir.
And let's run through real quick again. What are some examples of that type of information?
That would be call logs, voicemails, photos. If you wanted to pull up and see things you had saved, like your alarms that you had on your clock setting, if you'd set any of those kind of things you would see on there.
All right. And in a nutshell, that kind of information, if you just opened up the phone itself, that's kind of the information you could go and see for yourself if you just went through the phone, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. But there's other types of information on the phone as well.
Yes, sir, there is.
And that's information that a simple user can't necessarily access. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
All right. And tell us more about that information. First of all, where is it stored, how is it stored, and how is it accessed by in your lab?
Phones use many times SQLite databases to store information. They will go in, and inside those SQLite databases are things we're able to obtain by doing the full file system extraction. And things you may see in that from a big one's called KnowledgeC database, you can see if the phone has been turned, if it's in portrait mode straight up and down, or it's been turned to vertical and landscape mode. You can see if the power goes out on the phone from the power log database, and what kind of battery percentage you may have. It also will have things in there in the encrypted databases. It'll have geolocation stuff, from GPS stuff. It'll contain things like Bluetooth connections, where you can see if your phone connected to a Bluetooth device previously, and when was the last time it connected to it. And those are some of the things you can find in the different databases.
All right, you just used a few words there. First of all, I think you said SQLite, right?
Yes, sir.
What is that, and what does that mean?
The SQLite database is a database that's contained, the best way to think of it is think of just one solid file. All the information is contained inside that file. That file will go through, and once it fills up, it will delete out the oldest stuff and keep the newest stuff. If you think about your phones, you use your phones a lot. Usually what's going to start filling up on your phones are photos, videos, music, apps, when you put those on there, those kind of things. And you'll start losing size on your phone. Well, the SQLite database, because it's a file, it's not going to continuously grow and eat into all of that space. It's going to take up a certain amount to begin with because it's an operating system, but it stays within that contained file, and that's where the information is. And it's also set up by tables, too. So you would have to go in and look at the different tables to be able to interpret the information.
Okay. Now, those types of databases, I think you just said, they're typically self-contained.
Yes, sir.
They don't just keep writing to cover the entire phone memory, do they?
No, sir. If you had a SQLite database like KnowledgeC, for example, it's not. If you just continuously took your phone and went and changed the orientation of it, or you went and started doing things like plugging it into an outlet to charge up or unplugging it, doing different things like that, it's not going to eat up all your memory in the phone. Your memory is going to be mainly eaten up usually by photos, videos, apps that you download, things like that.
Is there a shelf life of this type of database information on a phone? Does it override itself after a period of time?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay. And just generally speaking, how often is that type of database stored on a phone? How long is it stored, I should say?
It depends. Depends on how much you're using that database. Some databases will do, it may write information if you're using a lot within 2 days. If it's a location, like in a, encrypted cache database. It may hold it for 45 days. It's just going to depend how much, because it's self-contained, it needs that room. So it's always the newest in, the oldest out on that database. And it goes through constantly doing that. So it depends, it really depends on how much you're using that database, whether you may see something that's 45 days old in there, or you may see something that's 2 days old or 2 weeks old.
All right. And you mentioned a Knowledge C database. Is that a type of SQLite database?
Yes, sir, it is.
And what are some of the things you would expect to find in a Knowledge C database?
Many times in the Knowledge C database, you'll see different things where you may see orientation changes. You may see if somebody pushes a button on their phone, like a power button, or used to be a home button in the older model of iPhones. You could see different things like that. You can also see things that it will also talk with the PowerLog database, where it'll show you the percent of battery life you have left. If you plug it in, you start charging it. It'll go through and look at all those kind of different things to see, or just a few of the things it'll look at.
Okay. All right, and you mentioned location storage, and that's a type of Knowledge C database, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, so it's not unlimited storage for location points on a phone, correct?
Well, let me correct that. Actually, Knowledge C, you have all separate databases that do location.
Okay.
You have the cache database, you have the cache encrypted database, or just name a few that will save location information.
All right. And so phones, depending on how the user has their settings, will store location data, correct?
Yes, sir. A user can make a selection on their phones whether they want to always give out their location only while using an app or never. It's a setting that a user gets to choose if they want or accepts by default.
Sorry. And what are the different types of location data that a phone can store?
A phone can store many things. It can store cell towers that it's seen. Depending on the database it comes out of, if it's the encrypted cache database, a lot of times it'll tell you what networks it's seen, but will not tell you the exact date and time that it has seen those networks. But it will tell you it's at some point in its life it's seen this network at this location. You have the cache database, many times it'll go through, and that'll be pulling GPS information. You'll have also databases that'll pull cell phone tower information if it's available.
And just, again, generally speaking, would GPS location information be more accurate than something like a cell phone tower location information?
Yes, sir, it would be.
All right. And, again, speaking generally, Lieutenant Dove, when you do a phone extraction, are you altering the data that you're pulling off the phone in any significant way?
And no, sir, we're not.
Okay. And how do you tell that? How can you know that for sure?
For example, if we use a phone and use GrayKey to do the extraction on it, it'll produce a report, and in the report it'll tell us if it was successfully pulling it. It also will give us an MD5 hash value at the end, which is a mathematical algorithm that goes through and computes a very long number with letters and numbers. We can then take the extraction and run our own hash against it for an MD5 and compare it with another tool to make sure those two numbers match, and then that means that no data has been altered.
Okay. And have you performed these MD5 comparisons for the three phones we're going to talk about today?
Yes, sir.
And you're confident in telling this jury that nothing you did significantly, any of the data that you're going to tell them about today?
Correct.
All right. Let me ask you real quick, what is a Faraday bag?
A Faraday bag is a bag that's used to put items in that can receive cell phone, Bluetooth connections, Wi-Fi connections, GPS things. It helps to block those items from being received on the device.
Okay. And are there other ways to block a cell phone from receiving those types of signals?
Yes, sir.
And what are some of those ways?
You can also place the phone in airplane mode. In airplane mode, when you set your phone to that, you will not be able to receive any Wi-Fi connectivity or cell phone connectivity from the cell towers. You can also remove the SIM card. It's another way of ensuring that you're not receiving those things. The difference in airplane mode versus a Faraday bag is the phone will still be able to receive GPS coordinates.
Okay. All right. And what danger are we concerned about when we talk about putting a phone in a Faraday bag or in airplane mode?
That somebody can wipe the phone remotely.
Okay. And specifically, when you say somebody, who?
Anybody that would have, take an iPhone, for instance, if somebody knows a user's iCloud name and password, they could get on, say the iPhone's lost or stolen, and it will wipe that phone.
Okay. And so if somebody has to have the Apple credentials, if it's an iPhone, it would have to be that person who could wipe that phone remotely, correct?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Let me ask you this. Is there a way for someone to remotely alter the phone in any way short than just a full wipe?
You could do it by connecting a phone and doing an iCloud backup, for instance, with an iPhone. And then you would have to go through and remove whatever you wanted to, and then you would restore that phone to the previous iCloud backup you did. And then that way the phone would only go back to that previous state, and that's what it would show you.
Okay. But is there a way to remotely, other than the process you just talked about, is there a way to remotely access a phone and, say, alter a call log, for instance?
No, sir, not that I'm aware of.
Or any other piece of singular data on a phone. Is there a way to alter it remotely?
No, sir, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And in terms of policy, is for SLED, is it SLED policy to collect phones and put them in Faraday bag?
No, sir.
Is there a SLED policy that governs how to collect cell phones from a crime scene or otherwhere or from elsewhere?
The manual for evidence collection through the forensic lab discusses taking a phone and place it into airplane mode if available and removing the SIM card.
All right, let's talk about time real quick. How does a cell phone time, how is it set? Let me ask you that. The cell time phone, you see on a cell phone, how is it set?
Cell phone time is set through the provider. Most of the times the phones will come default, they will auto set to whatever time zone you're in, along with your provider, whether it be T-Mobile, Verizon, it sets through their servers. That way they know how to bill people, and they can also check it for usage time too.
Okay. And is a cell phone kind of like my oven where I set the time and a year later it's like 10 minutes off?
No, sir, not usually, unless you went in and removed the auto times on it. But then you would see traces of that when you look at it, that somebody's changed the time zone. It will go back to the original time zone. Whereas if you drove from South Carolina to Alabama, for instance, right after you cross that state line within a minute, your phone's going to update to that current time zone, which is an hour behind us, automatically.
All right. And so when we compare two phones and we compare events on two different phones that occur, you know, either at the same or similar times, are those time references the same?
Yes.
Right. And how are those time references synced?
They're synced through the server. Each phone is going to be synced through the server individually. And then when you look at them, you can see what time zone they were set in, along with the reports, along with looking to see, and then you can always confirm if you needed to through like call detail records or something else if you want to go another step into validating the call logs versus what it's seeing from the cell phone provider.
Okay. I'm going to show you, it's in evidence as States Exhibit 204. I don't know where 204 is. It's not ID only. It was introduced yesterday.
Stand for a moment. Thank you.
show you. It's been, this is in evidence. It's State's Exhibit 204. And I'm going to ask you if you recognize that, sir.
Yes, sir, I do.
All right. And what is that item?
This is an iPhone that we received in case 7021-0204. It was item one that, well, after being processed, belonged to Maggie Murdoch.
Okay. And you received that phone. Do you recall when you received that phone?
I would have to check my notes on the actual date. It was in June. I believe it was June of 2021. I received the phone from our evidence intake at SLED.
Okay. And what did you do when you first received the phone and you went to examine it?
When I received the phone, I returned to our unit where our evidence vault is held. I logged the item in to evidence. One of the processes we have when we log items in is we take photos of the item as it comes in. If it's got a cracked screen to it, we'll photograph that. If it doesn't have it, we'll photograph that. Once the item then is photographed, we'll go through, we'll process the phone as far as for evidence, where we'll go in, we'll look at the phone, we'll pull the SIM card out if it hadn't been pulled out, we'll check the IMEI number, we'll log it into our system, we'll place stickers on the phone and on the bag to itself. Once that's done, then we'll take it to our evidence vault and sign it into a shelf on our evidence vault.
Okay. I'm going to show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 277. Do you recognize that, sir?
Yes, sir. This is a photo I took when I examined this item.
All right. And that item being?
Item one, the iPhone belonging to Maggie Murdoch. Okay.
And at this time, State moved to introduce Exhibit 277 to evidence.
Objection. Submitted.
And I'm going to show this. Are we up on the elbow?
We are.
Okay, what is this picture of? What do we see on this picture?
This is a picture of her settings on her iPhone. I opened the settings. I went in and pulled up. It shows the name of Maggie Murdoch has been entered as a name for the phone. It also shows that the phone has been placed in airplane mode, that the Wi-Fi connection is off, Bluetooth connection is on, cell connection is placed in airplane mode.
Okay. So this is a picture you took, correct?
Yes, sir, it is.
And did you alter any of these settings yourself?
No, sir.
Did you access this phone?
No, sir, I did not.
And we see the phone's in airplane mode, correct?
Yes, sir.
And is that the condition you received the phone?
Yes, sir, it is.
And was it? Do you recall if it was powered off when you received it?
It was powered on when I received it.
But it was in airplane mode, correct?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to show you State's Exhibit 276. Do you recognize that, sir?
Yes, sir, I do.
And is that a picture you took?
Yes, sir, it is. It's one I took during our examination of the phone.
All right. And that's, again, Maggie's phone?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. And at this time, State would move to introduce State's Exhibit 276 in evidence.
No objection. Without objection.
And real briefly, what is that picture of?
This is a picture of one of the screens on the phone that show the different apps on there. It also shows on there that there has been notifications received to those apps, such as CVS Pharmacy. It shows the little number one there that has been received a notification to that app.
All right. And when you see a notification like that, what does that mean to you? What does that tell you?
That they have been, one, that they had their notifications turned on, because if you go through and set your apps not to notify you, then you won't receive them or see them. that a notification has been turned on for that CVS app, for instance, and that she has received a notification on there.
All right. I'm going to show you, it's been marked as State's Exhibit 275. And do you recognize that, sir?
Yes, sir, I do.
What is that?
This is the location service from Maggie Murdoch's phone. During my examination, I pulled this up, and it shows whether apps and different things, if one, location service was turned on, but then two, if it was always running, if it was only while the app was being used, or it was set to never.
And at this time, State would move to introduce Exhibit 275 in evidence.
Okay. Did it without objection.
Okay, can you read that, Lieutenant Dove, on the screen?
Yes, sir, I can.
And at the top, what is that? What do we see there?
At the top of it, on the left-hand side, you see the time of 12:30 with a little triangle next to it for location services. Then on the right-hand side, you see the little airplane to indicate the phone's in airplane mode. Then you see the battery, and it's hard to tell on the screen, but I believe it's yellow, it looks like, on there, that it's a low battery. Then it's the location services. It shows that location services are turned on. Then it goes down through several different apps, not all of them, but then shows like AccuWeather is set to never record locations. You got Amazon Alexa that's always, the App Store only while using the app, the Apple Store while using the app, Apple Watch Faces while using, Apple Watch Workout while using, and BCBS Toolkit while using.
Okay. So these are user settings that presumably the owner of the phone would have set, correct?
Yes, sir. Majority of the time when you add a new app to your phone, it asks you, do you want to allow location services? Do you want to allow it all the time, only while using the app, or never? You can also go into your own settings and change those location services.
Okay. And for most of these apps we see on here, it seems to say that location services only be used while using. What does while using mean?
It indicates when you pull the app up and the app is in use, that's when it's recording the location that you're at. Whether it's running in the background or you pull it up and then close it completely out. Mm-hmm.
So if no one is actively using a particular app, the phone's not going to record location data, correct?
Correct, for that app, yes, sir.
For those settings where it says while using, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, I'm going to approach and show you Exhibit 278. You recognize that, sir?
Yes, sir, I do.
And what is that?
This is a picture of Maggie Murdoch's phone I took while I was doing the examination of it, and it shows the recent call log. Okay.
At this time, I would move to introduce State's Exhibit 278.
Okay. Submit it.
And this is the recent call log from Maggie Murdoch's phone, correct?
Yes, sir, correct.
And we see some entries that are red and some are black. What does that mean?
The red entries on there indicate missed calls, calls that have been received by the phone but were not answered.
Okay. And we see the word Alex followed by a numeral 5. What does that mean?
That would indicate the phone has recorded that there were 5 missed calls from the person identified as Alex in that contact list.
Okay. And in addition, we see a missed call from Buster, correct?
Yes, sir, correct.
And 2 missed calls from John Marvin. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And can we see the times or dates on this screen right now?
It shows the date on there. As far as the day of the week, it does not show the calendar date or the times.
Okay. And finally, I'm going to show you Exhibit 279. Do you recognize this?
Yes, sir, I do.
What is that?
This is a photo of Maggie Murdoch's phone. When I was doing the examination, one of the other things I did was open the messages to look at it and take a photo of that.
And that's a picture you took, correct?
Yes, sir, I took that photo.
And so at this time, State would move to introduce exhibit, State's Exhibit 279 today.
No, sir.
Submitted.
All right. And this is those recent messages from Maggie, correct?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. And what types of messages would show up in this inbox?
In this inbox, you would receive SMS messages, a regular text message, and also MMS messages, which ones may also have a photo attached to them, would show up.
Okay. All right. And I see to the left of most of these a dot. What does that dot indicate?
That dot indicates messages that have not been read or opened.
Okay. Okay. So after you took those processing pictures of Maggie's phone, what did you do?
I continued to process the phone. I took the gray key extraction I did with the phone. I ran it through Cellebrite Physical Analyzer. Went through it, looked for information relevant that may help the investigators, also to see what kind of things were going on the day of June 7th, 2021. And then from there, after I finished that one, that's when I ran it, the extraction through Axon, to try to see if I could validate what I was seeing.
Okay. And you mentioned it, but this was a full physical extraction on Maggie's phone?
It was a full file system extraction.
Full file system. Okay. And you process it in Cellebrite?
Yes, sir.
And does Cellebrite produce a full file system report?
Yes, sir, it will.
All right. And what? Explain to the jury what that is and what it does.
A full file system report from Cellebrite is going to have everything that it can decode and then put in a readable format for you. It's going to give you things like your health database stuff, like to show you your steps that you're taking, your calls that you've made or missed or received, your emails, your text messages. It's going to tell you if you connected to a Bluetooth device. It's going to tell you if you went and were in a certain area and you have geolocation information, such as GPS information. It's also going to tell you if you have mobile payments in there, where you can look and see what cards you had in your mobile payments. Just to name a few, it will pull thousands of pages of information if you ran a full one and pulled it. It'll also give you the configurations of apps, also give you the databases too in that report.
Okay. And you just mentioned it, but a full Cellebrite report is rather large, correct?
Yes, sir. Depending on the size of the phone and how much information is on the phone, I have seen them run over 148 gigs in size for one report.
What is a gig?
A gig is a measurement that is used for data. Most phones nowadays, when you get them, are going to go 64 gigs. It's your smaller end, and they go up from there to 128 or 256 or even a terabyte now. It's how much data it'll hold.
And phones, let's say just new models that the phones that Apple's selling, what's a common size that's sold by Apple today?
Most of the time, people will acquire a 126 or 128 gig size. Then the next size up is the 256.
This full size Cellebrite report that you produced for Maggie's phone, do you recall how large it is?
No, sir, not the full file system, I don't.
Right, but it's large, correct?
Yes, sir. It's if I remember correctly, it's probably about 68 gigs in total size.
And if you wanted to print everything in that report, could you approximate how many pages it would take?
No, sir. I would be venturing to guess. Looking at the timeline, for instance, in a report like that, you're probably talking about 9,000 pages just for the timeline section of that report.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to show you a box. I think the marker's on the inside, so you might need to open it up, but it's a State's Exhibit 280. You can open it up. All right. And what is the contents of that box?
The contents of this box is a portable, solid-state external hard drive.
Okay. And is that something you've had access to before?
Yes, sir.
And what did you do with that external hard drive?
On this external hard drive, I provided a copy of the file system report from Cellebrite. I placed it on this hard drive.
And for whose phone?
This is for Maggie Murdoch's phone.
And you estimated it was in the neighborhood of about 60 gigabytes, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Plus or minus?
Yes, sir. It could be plus, probably plus that.
And that represents the full file system that you pulled off of Maggie's phone, is that correct?
Yes, sir, in a report format.
And the phone's in evidence sitting right there in front of you. Is there any significant difference in the data that's contained on that phone and contained on that hard drive other than the ability to access it?
That's the only difference.
Okay. All right. Your Honor, at this time, State would move to introduce State's Exhibit 280 into evidence.
Objection.
Submitted. All right, Lieutenant Dove, we just talked about if we printed all that, it would be thousands of pages, correct?
Yes, sir.
And so for today, you've printed shorter reports that we can look at and discuss for Maggie's phone, is that correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
But those reports are pulled from that full Cellebrite report on that hard drive.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to show you something that's marked as State's Exhibit 281. Take a look at that, sir. And do you recognize that?
Yes, sir, I do.
What is that?
This is a report, a Cellebrite report from Maggie Murdoch's phone that was pulled just for call logs with a filter established for just June 5th, 2021 to June 7th, 2021 as parameters for this phone.
And so those are call logs that were stored on Maggie's phone, is that correct?
Yes, sir, they were.
And explain to the jury real quick, they heard from a Verizon representative this morning, what's the difference between call logs stored on that phone and call logs that might be stored by a company like Verizon?
When call logs are stored on the phone, one of the things on this report, for instance, it'll have network unknown. It's not pulling network information, so it doesn't matter whether you're using T-Mobile or Verizon for your phone. It's still going to pull the call logs. Even if you were to go and switch carriers from Verizon to T-Mobile, it would still pull the call logs from the database. One of the other things it'll do is it'll record times that the phone's receiving the call along with the amount of time that you spend on the call. It'll show if it was answered or missed on there.
Okay.
We're going to take a break.
Yes, sir.
At this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you go to the jury room, we'll take a 15-minute break.
And that's where that segment wraps up. One more for you today. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts to not miss any of our continuing coverage. You can get a commercial-free experience by subscribing through Apple Podcasts right now. Even try that out for 3 days free. With that, you'll have access to all of our programs, all of them commercial-free, for supporting us through Apple Podcasts. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us. Coverage continues in the next chapter.